Good afternoon, this is Paul Sigrist for the National Park Service. Today is Monday, August 21st, 1995. I'm in Albany, New York at the Good Samaritan Lutheran Home, and I'm here with Hector Tonetti. Mr. Tonetti came from Italy, from the north of Italy, and he came to America twice. The first time was in 1909 when he was 3 1/2, and then he came back in 1920 when he was 14. Mr. Tonetti, can we begin by you giving me your birth date, please?
July 9th, 1905.
And where in Italy were you born?
You want the address?
Well, you can give it to me, sure.
Very small town. I was born in Piemonte. I pronounce it in Italian now, Spanish Italian. Piemonte, north of Italy. A very small town named Brusnengo.
Can you spell that?
Yeah. B-R-U-S-N-E-N-G-O. Brusnengo. It's there's some sort of German tone in there. Nengo, like Bergamo, for example. So that town, that part, a little bit of German and Italian. Well, anyway, I was born there, yeah, in the province at that time, province of Vercelli, was it?
Yeah. Can you spell that, please?
Oh, yeah. That's the address, province of Vercelli, still is. P-R-O-V, you know, period. C-E-L-L-I, Vercelli. E-L-L-I, Vercelli.
What can you tell me about this small town that you were born in?
I tell you, I was born there. And we had a little bit of a farm, a family farm, very small, very difficult to make a living. So my father and one of his brothers and so on, they started to emigrate because we couldn't make a living there, you see. That's before I was born. And the immigration was very big. And from the north of Italy, our area there, the immigration was divided up North America, United States, and then Africa, South Africa at that time mostly, and South America, and North America, the United States mostly. Canada, not much. And some would also emigrate for a few months and so on within Europe. Switzerland, France, they actually go to work for a season, like, you know, for emigration, because the living was better in this country I just mentioned than Italy. Because Italy, you see, comprised north of Italy, Central Italy and Southern Italy, geographically speaking, different, and the cultures are a little bit different.
Why did your family choose to come to the United States?
Because, first of all, somebody else was here. My father's, not brother, but, one of his brother, and cousins and relatives. Because somebody that they knew were already here. And from the north of Italy, from our area, from our village, from our town, most of us, landed in New York City to work in the finest hotels New York had at that time, and included Waldorf Astoria, the Plaza, a very old hotel, you know, been there already, and they made a career in that. And when I came after in 1920, I was, just as I said, 14, but I lied. I said I was 16, you know, to get the working paper to the head waiter. And the head waiter asked me, bring me the birth certificate. The following day, my brother, who had been here before, 3 years before, said, just tell him that the next day, or that you forgot to bring the paper. I forgot, the head waiter forgot at that time. I wasn't quite 15, I was supposed to be 16. The law already was in effect then, but it was not enforced like now, you know. Now you couldn't do anything like that. And I worked in the hotel, Biltmore, just built, and right there in the Grand Central Station area. And it only worked a couple of years. Now you want me to tell me my personal story?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, I want to go back.
Right,
I want to go back to
Why, yes. Because we were very poor, the farmer wouldn't provide enough for the expanded family, because there were three brothers, you see, out of father and mother, three brothers, divide the living quarters and divide the property, the land to cultivate, and so on. And the cattle, for example, was only one cow, and it couldn't live. So somebody had to, and the immigration was very strong at that time.
What was your father's name?
Giuseppe.
And what was his family background? What do you know about his background?
Oh, yeah, background. He was born already with two, three brothers. And was there a sister? Yeah, I guess one sister. Yeah. And the background was farmer, but he didn't like to work on the farm. So he immigrated before he married to South America in Argentina, Buenos Aires. Immigrated there. And then he got tired of working there. He went with his father, my grandfather, one day. And somehow the grandfather was a little bit getting tired of staying in the same place. He moved to the United States, Los Angeles, where he died. And my father left Los Angeles. Did I confuse the name now? Los Angeles
and Buenos Aires.
So
he moved to Buenos Aires.
Yeah, and my father was still in Buenos Aires. We only stayed very short time after his father came and went to Los Angeles. But his father wanted him to go back home and control work on the farm and so on. So he didn't want to go. My father was only in his early 20s. He went to South Africa instead, in Cape Town, South Africa. But at that time, was just during the Boer War. You heard of Boer War? B-O-E-R, the Dutch against the English.
1901.
Right, you got it right. And they were fighting for control of the area. You see, the English and the Dutch, the Europeans, you know, were fighting. And so there was a war, a local war, and my father was timid. He was small man, physically like me. So he went back home. But still, he didn't like the little farm. It was too much work. So he went and landed in New York City. That's how we happened to.
And, this is the 1909 trip?
Right, of course, I was born already. I was 3.5 years old. I was born in 1905.
So the whole family went to New York
right,
in 1909.
Right. The whole family consisted of, I was the second, it's two children, two boys, father and mother. That's it. And
how long did you stay?
So then we arrived in New York for hotel work. My father was not a very ambitious man, and he never made much of a grade in the kitchen. In fact, he was never a cook, a real cook, just a kitchen worker. And my mother had to go to work in the sweatshops. You probably heard of them, famous sweatshops in New York City, manufactured clothes. And Jews were in control, all those. A famous sweatshop in New York. So he didn't like it much, but my mother couldn't stand it. He had babies to take care. And she became pregnant, so she told my father, I was born already, became pregnant with my younger brother, that she wanted to have the baby in the village where she was born. She knew that the maid takes care of the birth of babies.
The midwife?
Midwife. And she knew that his wife was safe. She already had two children. And she wanted to have the baby there. She said, oh, she left and her husband was there alone. She went there, she had a baby there. And we stayed. This was in 1909. 1911 we went back. Oh, and then the war arrived. Well, there was a Libyan war against Italy also at that time, before the First World War, which started in 1914. And 1914, but Italy didn't enter until 1915. And we got stuck with the war, and to make it short, we re-entered there in 1920.
So the whole family then, came back in 1920?
Yeah, the whole family. Well, my father was always here.
Oh.
Yeah.
Everyone but your father.
Was my mother, and no girls. Three boys. But the oldest boy came first, 1917, instead of 1920, when the war was raging, 1917. And he came over accompanied by a local responsible man, and he went right in the hotel. And then two of us, older, I was at that time, how old was I? 1920.
14.
My gosh, I was 14, yeah. Oh yeah, that's the first time I'm thinking about. I arrived here, I was 3 and a half, and I went back at 5 and a half, six. I made the great schools over there. And that's the only schooling I've had all my life. 7 years in school, 6 grades. I repeated 1 grade to keep you, to explain why. And the reason, there was a reason there between the teacher and my mother. And so we're ever since. Then we come back.
In 1909, when you first came, do you know the name of the ship that you came across in 1909?
Yeah. The name of the ship was a French line. Because from the north of Italy, the person responsible, travel agent. The travel agent up north said, it's easy from us here, from up north, right? Go through France, take the ship in Le Havre, France, 1909, and from Le Havre it's much shorter, see the ocean is narrower. And so we did. And we took only 8 days. 8 days. Ordinarily, it would have been 11, 12, 15. In fact, in 1920, when we arrived after the war, Italian line, Dante Alighieri, name of the ship, 1920, in March, it took us 18 days. Because it was in 1920, there was still shortage of coal. They were using coal. It was a steamship, you know. It was in coal for fuel, and shortage of the ship. And all in all, from Genoa to New York, 18 days.
And that was in 1920.
And yet, 1909, with a French ship, only 11 days.
Do you remember the name of the French ship?
The Lorraine.
The Lorraine.
I remember that.
Were you ever told any stories about when your mother gave birth to you?
Yeah.
Is there any story about that circumstance?
Well, it seems that I was wanted. Yeah. I was wanted, yes and no. Stories, not until I was a 3 and a half, I started to understand. Three and a half. We had enough to eat, our own land, our own house of the grandparents, and
is that your mother's parents or your
father's? No, the father's side always. Uh-huh. The mother, same village, but she moved to the father's house, and my father had two brothers. One was normal; he went to work in Africa also, and we got lost. He died there, but the other brother was sort of retarded, like you know, and we have a problem with him. And he remained a bachelor, never married.
Do you know what your mother's maiden name was?
Oh, yes. Maria, of course, Mary. Oliaro. O-L-I-A-R-O.
And what do you know about her family background?
Oh, definitely. Of course, I didn't know anything until I grew, until I was 4 or 5 years old, you don't understand. They were both, her father and mother, both born in the same village. They used to marry close, same village if possible. If at that time a young fellow would cross the brook that we had there on each side of the village and marry somebody there, they used to criticize him or her because they were marrying across the water, a stream, imagine that, across the water, there would be no luck and so on. That was already just like marrying here a foreigner almost, you know? Yeah. And so they were all close.
What was your mother's personality like?
She was very timid and not very practical. She never learned to become a professional seamstress in New York City, the sweatshops there. So she took in boarders instead, you know, boarders, the room and boarders, a single young fellow, you know, would arrive there. And as I said, my father never earned much, 50 cents at $1 a day, plus the meals, 6 days a week.
Which hotel did he work in?
Well, he worked at the Waldorf Astoria first also. The old was the old Waldorf Astoria, of course, not the one that's built there. The old one was on 42nd Street and Fifth Avenue. And the new one is 51st Park Avenue, something like that. I know about New York, you know, can't fool me.
What is your earliest memory? Your earliest memory?
My earliest memory?
Yes, what is the earliest memory that you have of your life?
Oh, I was a smart kid. Well, I was very close to my so-called retarded uncle, and he always kept me under his arm and so on, you know, and was very friendly with me. He used to take me to go over and during the vintage time, you know, we had the grapes walnuts. We had walnut trees, and we even made walnut oil, you know, very rich, edible oil.
Can you describe how that was done?
Pardon me?
Can you describe how the walnut oil was made?
The oil was made?
Yes, how did
they were
you
still
do that?
Using the press, old wood, with the weight, you know, big trunk, and a donkey around it to turn the, can't you think of the word now, anyway, and it's a press, you know, a regular press, the same as the grape press, and you could have made oil out of the walnuts, and I used to, we used to criticize me, he was bachelor, because he was not too normal. And they were used to criticize me, why Eusebius, name Eusebius, baby. And why you made all the oil out of that? So, it's so thick, so expensive, costs more than the olive oil. Olive oil, we had no olives up in northern Italy, remember that? There's a line there somewhere, in Tuscany. That's about in the more northeast area where they have olive trees. Tuscana, and the Riviera area, you know, the Riviera area, Genoa, and all that area there. And then you have to go down south toward Naples, southern Italy, Sicily, all that area. Very good olive oil, very good olives. And so we were using the press, and of course, our most produce that would pay for us was work hard and work in the vineyards, produce wine. See, because at that time the wine, well, Italy was behind France, the amount of production and so on. Now I understand that Italy produces as much wine as France does.
Can you talk to me about the procedure when you were in Italy of tending the vineyards and making wine?
I was 7, 8 years old when they put me to work after school. The season lasts about 2 weeks. That's the harvest season. Usually the first week of September, and then a week or two, depending the size of the property, how many yards you have, and produce that. Well, yeah, I did it myself, I ought to tell you, all right. I should remember, all right. We, the whole family, no schools, 1 or 2 weeks about. And the dates where was a proclamation from the mayor. They decided at the town hall when they should start pick the grapes and try to finish it, because they could go by the weather. You know, not every season has the same temperature. Sometimes the season a few days later on. And so, and then we start to work at sunrise until late at night for that week or 2 weeks. We had everybody in the family work to pick the grapes. Then we'd hire help. Usually people were still poorer than we were, with very little or no vineyards. Maybe just a garden, not for flowers, but a vegetable garden and fruit trees and so on, but not much vineyards. So they were working for others by the hour. And we had to work in order to pick the grapes at the right time and finish fast enough. The grapes were picked and crushed and started the fermentation the very same day. Because if you let the fermentation go haywire at night in the wine cellar, that's all wasted, you see. There. And so we did most of the pick enough, we knew how much we have to pick, and complete the job all day. You start to cut the grapes after the dew is off. D-E-W, formed during the night, and because we were producing very good, very honest, very conscientious at that time. Now this commercial, you know, they have ways of fixing the wines all over the world, you know, and trying to get that certain taste, a certain degree of alcoholic content and so on that they want, and they work for that. They don't care too much about the taste anyway. It was just natural. All right, we'd pick the grapes in the morning after the dew, where it says start about 9 o'clock in the morning, and with all the buckets and everything ready, the wagon, the horse or the mule or donkeys, couple of cows sometimes, and some of them, and the male neuter, the cow. Because the other one is male. And the oxen, the teams of oxen, were used in the farm to cultivate the land, you see. And now I think they go more for horses. Of course, now they have machines. And
Was there a certain technique to picking the grapes?
Well, they had to be just ripe, right way, not too much, not rotten. And pick the grapes, you look at it, take off a few bad, and in the basket there. We finish in the morning, early afternoon, pick the grapes. Then we take everything home right away. Those grapes had to be in the vat the same evening. Otherwise they would suffer the alcoholic contents, the strength of the grapes. And those that kernel is very, very ripe, they suffer during the night, you know, if you let them out too long. So we do as much as work possible in a full day. And and then we had vats. I was a kid, going top of the vat with a sort of a bucket there. The man would throw the grapes there, and I push it down the vat. The fermentation would last 8-10 days. See, when it stops gurgling, you know, when it stops gurgling and so on, then they transfer it, they stop the fermentation, they reuse it actually. And the first wine, the wine that would be sold, and the best part was the one that came from bottom of the vat, not being pressed at all. The pressed, because it was all the grapes and a lot of, you know, what do you call it? Well, the stems, you know, the stems in there would take care of some of the juice, so they had to be pressed. But this first one, the most expensive wine, no pressing, came out natural, then transferred to another vat. And the fermentation would continue.
How were the grapes pressed?
Right. The old days when we were kids, small farms and so on.
You're pointing to your feet.
Up to here, my feet.
Up to your
7, 8, you heard about it. I actually did it. 7, 8, 10 years old, you know. And everything has to be done.
And was there a trick to doing it somehow? Pardon me? Was there a trick? I mean, how did you learn how to stop grapes?
We were born there. We'd watch them. We could open our eyes and we learn by watching. And then traditionally, they follow the custom of the parents, father to son and so on, carry on. And a custom like that by hand, it lasted for centuries. Until about, then we started to have machinery, 19, before the First World War, I was there, 1910, 11, something like that, we had crushers, you know. Is that the way you could call it in English, crusher? Yeah. And you transfer from one barrel to the other, and then the machine crusher was pressed by, you know, you turn the handle and so on by hand, and then we had electricity by then, and then you goes through the press, and the press of at the bottom, the juice was clean, no seed, no stems, of course, no, and the skin was all crushed. And transfer in a vat that would mature. First, it had to stop the fermentation. Then, when the fermentation was stopped, it was put in a permanent vat, permanent for months. It would mature, get ready to drink, which would not be until the next spring. You see, because the grape, when it's freshly crushed, it's actually sweet. The juice remains sweet for weeks and a few months, and it's not good to drink, not to make wine, you know, because wine has to be aged. And then during the winter, they used to transfer in and put in permanent vats or big bottles and so on, depending how much, and let it stay until. Well, after a couple of transfers, at least three maybe. And the wine for sale and for the drink to be good, you'd have to wait until the following four of 1 year.
How would the
you
wine
could drink any time before, you know.
How was it stored in the meantime? How?
Always one wet to a vat to another vat.
And in large
and
vats.
Yeah. And when the vats, there was no more room, and it was small containers. We use also glass. What do you call them in English? And the wine would the must, must, because it was not wine yet, so still they had to watch it. it would ferment there. And then in the fall, you start to transfer it and taste it and so on, mix it one kind or the other, because the grapes were different varieties of grapes, not all one grape only. And the blend of grapes was better than having just one. One grape is special. It was very good for quantity, but light, thin, nearly transparent. The other was instead very rich, heavy, and not too much volume. And then you have to watch it. And then you can start sell it. In fact, in bulk, we used to sell it in bulk because we were so small. We couldn't, we didn't have the manpower, and it was not profitable to finish all the process and then bottle the wine and wait till it aged. And so we used to sell it in bulk during the winter. A special mediator used to call them, wholesaler used to buy the wine like that. But then they had to wait till it ripened right, and it was a proper taste. And the good wine would start 2 years later.
Was this a major business for you?
But the locals were drinking it much before for me.
Was this the major business for your family?
Yes. Most of the families over there, that village area. And although everybody had one or more cows, one or more horse, some donkey, the donkey usually all alone, and the mules. We had animals, and that was before the First World War, you know. And the trucks didn't show up until automobiles showed up.
Can you describe for me the house that you lived in on the farm?
Well, the houses there, they were built around the courtyard. The courtyard was, which still is, my old house that we're trying to sell now, but I'm having trouble. And around the courtyard was divided up, different ownership. You build a house around. You have one entrance to the courtyard. In the back, they had the stables, and the horses and animals and cows and so on will go in the back. The best part of the courtyard, where there was a view, a view of the Alps, look of the valley and so on, the animals would get there, the stables. Because the courtyard was actually the main part, because it was practical. They all come out from the same courtyard, houses, and they were short driveway to get into the street, you know. And they used to surround the view with the houses. If you wanted to have the view, beautiful views of the Alps, which we had all year round, we had to go on the top floor, you know, where you get the best view, and look at the back of the houses. And then you have the view.
What was the house made out of?
All brick and stone. Brick and stone, and all the local products, I mean, for that area here, because they used to produce a lime, lime for brickwork, brick and stone mixed, broken stone in the center, finished brick on the side, on the outside. Yeah, was all no wood. All my own, even now. They built a wood floor only lately, a few years ago, over sort of a new floor, you know, sort of very thin.
How was the house heated?
The house was heated originally, fireplace only, certain rooms, not the bedrooms ordinarily, because it would be too extravagant to heat up the bedroom to go to bed. And so we the first one to eat. Most important was the kitchen combination, kitchen and dining room, where you eat, and where you cooked. And the fire in the wood was, of course, owned ordinarily by part of the property. Property was scattered, not solid area. Small piece here, few square feet here. Well, not feet, but few square yards. And one was suitable for rain, and on the plain, the valley, where the valley started. And on the hills, the vineyards and woods, you know, everything was local. And every property had part wood, part vineyard, part fruit trees and so on. And we had the houses, as you said, made there. And then in the back, on the side, or at the end of that walk where the street is, we had a separate piece for fruits and vegetables, orchard and vegetables, you know.
What kinds of fruits did you raise?
Well, up in northern Italy, in Piemonte and Piedmont there, by the way, the main city is Torino, Turin, you heard of it. And in Lombardy is Milan. Milan is really the most very commercial. And Turin is still the corner of France and Italy. It's Turin. That was what we wanted to see most before kids is to go to Torino, you know. It was a big city. Where were we?
The fruits. What kind of fruits did you raise?
Right, at first. Because I came late. I came late. You have to go back centuries. Centuries ago, they had pears.
Well, in your time there, what did you have?
Yeah, the same thing. Pears, apples, and not the tropical fruit. That's what you want to know. And pears, apples, the best to produce. Grapes, for the not just for the wine, but also for grape, because you could preserve the grapes by putting on straw, and it would come kind of dry a little bit, like raisin, you know, and eat that in the winter, because we didn't go out and buy grape juice or the store. The mid temperature fruits, what do we call it over here?
The average.
Yeah, the temperature. The same as what we hear is it's quite a bit colder than when I was born. But the temperature there on Piemonte and any other yard, once you were down off the mountains, because the snow and ice would produce cold, you know. And it was grapes on the sunny side of the hill. Most used and worked on, because it had to be worked. But then and the other fruit, pears and apples, because you could preserve it through the winter by drying them, you know, on straw and so on. And peaches, even figs, warm enough for figs, peaches, and, apricots and prunes, and all those fruits. But when, as I said, when I got, it would stop at the olive. It was too cold for olive in our area. We didn't have any olives at all. And I said, the olive started on the Riviera. That's where Genoa is, and facing the Mediterranean, you know.
Getting back to the house, how did you light your house?
Well, we had no inside toilet.
How did you light light the house?
Lighted. Oh, yeah. All lamps. Oh, as I had to say, light to like it. Oil lamps for. We didn't have any electricity, because the whole town would have to have it, you know. Electricity, I think I remember now, 19. The war was already on in my house. Different houses depending on how the owners, you know, were living, and the money to buy. But you could, but the attachment electricity we had it already in 1913, 14, not before that.
What do you remember about the installation of the electricity?
Well, when they installed it in my house, it was in 19. My mother was alone. My father was already here. She didn't want the electricity connections over, were too expensive. We managed with lamps, keep on with that. And not only oil lamp, we used to use kerosene. Kerosene too. Kerosene, oil lamp, not, doesn't produce any light. You know, it's all right too. And then the candles, we had candles also. And the kerosene for the stable, we had to milk the cows, you know. And the kitchen attached, central, yeah. In 19, I remember, it had to be 1910, not before, you know. Yeah, that's what we had. But the electric general installment in the village, in the center of the village, well, they had it way back, 19, when I was born, 1905 or something like that. Yeah.
What were your mother's objections to getting the electricity in the house?
Well, she found out it was more better light, more practical, and less expensive. You didn't have to carry your lamp, oil lamp, with you to light a few square feet, you know, at a time, the whole room.
Do you remember them installing the electricity into the house?
Oh, yes.
How did they do that?
Oh, the wires are open.
The wires are on the outside of the wall?
On the outside wall, because it's solid brick and stone. The houses in those days were built, even now, a mixture of brick and stone, because those are two local products. Stones from the mountains, from the hills, you know, and bricks down in the plain. They had brick factories, a lot of brick, yeah. So there was lime and there was brick. And then the stones, I said, steps, for example, were all stone. Steps from one floor to another, and all very, very solid. And the bricks were curved. Yeah, curved.
Curved. Bricks were curved.
Curved, yeah. Those are the original ones, yeah. Curved like that. And just lay one on top of the other. And they have to be checked occasionally. Yeah, yeah.
Is there a piece of furniture in your house that sticks out in your mind for some reason?
Well, I tell you, the bed would be, I guess, when two boys, we were sleeping together, when the big bed came in, and it was made locally, walnut, yeah, because walnuts, by the way, I forgot to mention those, walnut and prunes, walnuts and prunes, was a local, were very good, regular English walnuts, you know, we call them here. But, yeah.
And so your parents or somebody had a bed made?
Oh, yeah, made to order. They had carpenters and cabinet makers, really. They had to build the furniture. But the bed was the most important because the most useful. We could put a box on the floor for children, especially, and then put a mattress over in there, not a regular bed. Then the beds came with legs, you know, they were drier and used them. And furniture were only the necessary boxes for the equivalent of dresser and storeroom storage boxes. Yeah.
Was there a piece of furniture in the house that was considered particularly precious?
Well, some of them
inherited
my house, no. There was from my grandfather, yeah, but ordinary. The dresser, yeah. Oh, yeah, we had dresser a long time before I was born. Living room was a luxury, living room. Only those who were able to make money outside of the property in selling and buying, you know, doing, especially the men. The men were, was their territory to load it with produce and then buy some furniture, whatever they needed, or sheets and so on, you know, from the city markets. Oh my gosh, furniture. Period furniture, where do you think it comes from? Centuries ago. Louis XIV, I worked in furniture. I know something about that. So don't try to catch me, because I fool you. And I worked in period furniture 10 years, between 1920 and 1929, 9 years. Then I got sick. That was it.
Tell and, me about your religious life in Italy. What religion were you?
Well, in a small village like that, it still is. There's only one religion, the Catholic, Roman Catholic. And there may be two or three churches, but now they cut them down. Instead of having two or three small ones, they have one large one to save heat and all that. But the Roman Catholic is more than that. And all over Italy was the Roman Catholic. It was not until centuries later, oh my God, that the evangelists, the like Seventh-day Adventists and so on, those are all imports from the United States, most of them.
How did you practice your religion at home?
Oh, it was a must to go to church every Sunday morning. I'm talking about children now, because I was a kid. And we had to go to church every Sunday morning, serve on the altar and assist the priest and so on, and learn the catechism, what we call it. We were too small to read the Bible. And is that what you want to know?
What about at home? How did you do, what did you do at home?
Well, at home we had to, the average house, because it was some stubborn or a little bit different, follow the rules. Sunday mass every Monday, Sunday, you know, and have your baptism and first, and then the other one, first communion. Those were a must, you know, for everybody, every parents. And
were there any prayers that you were taught by your parents as children?
Yes, some depending on the parents, on the.
Your parents?
Well, you know, my parents were not very very fussy about it. Yeah, we had to say some prayer, but we could also whisper it. We didn't have to say it out loud, just before going to sleep. Yeah, and we had to, my mother wasn't very strict on that for different reasons. And my father neither. No, we were not very religious at all, not in our house. We were told to go to school, to catechism school, and go to mass every Sunday morning, and so on. But if you skip once in a while, find some kind of excuse, you know. My mother was peculiar. She wasn't going to church, only irregularly, because she hated the parish priest. And the reason she gave us, our kids, was that he was so rough and so intolerant that he was threatening, especially the grandmothers, you know, that if they didn't follow the line and the rules of the church and the rules of the and they preach that our departed mothers and fathers and grandfathers, they would suffer, they would go to hell. And here is one true story here. My grandmother's side was very, my grandmother and my father's side, I never knew her. And she was very devout, and she was a guru and so on. But the parish priest was kind of tough. He expected the survive part of the husband and wife, for example, to make sure that would be enough money devoted to the church after the partner died, you know. Otherwise, the Lord would he's not supposed to. Well, it would hurt her family, and this really happened. They used to have communion and confession regularly, continuously almost, and quietly, you know, during weekdays, and confessional. So a neighbor of my mother was praying quietly in a corner in the dark, and she could overhear from the confessional what the priest was threatening my grandmother, my mother's side, that shouting to. And this woman said, yes, I heard it myself, because it was in that corner. The priest thought they were alone, but they were not. That he threatened my grandmother that if she didn't leave 100,000 lira, which at that time was not a fortune, but was a lot of money, 1,000 lira to the church when my grandfather died, that she would go to hell. And he shouted that. So this woman overheard, and she told my mother. My mother hated that parish priest. She didn't want to talk to him anymore. You know. Says, yes, the woman heard herself. And nobody liked that. He was very, very rude, rough, you know. So.
What about practicing religious holidays, for instance? What holidays did you observe?
The same Roman Catholic Church all over the world is the same. Same holidays.
Can you describe same for holidays. Me how your family... celebrated Christmas.
Well, the biggest, believe it or not, but most important over there is not Christmas, but it's Easter. The resurrection, they consider that much more important. Because the story of the Magi and so on, I don't know. Anyway, they pay more attention for Easter holidays, even now, than Christmas. Over here, Christmas is everything, you know.
How did your family celebrate Easter?
Oh, like everybody else, go to Mass and, you know, confession first, preparation for confession, communion. That was a must, confession and communion. Now the confession, not so much anymore, but communion still is.
Was there a special meal that your family had at Easter time, or...?
I don't think they pay much attention. I never remember paying much attention on their diets, you know. Are you talking about the Jewish, Orthodox Jews, for example, are much more strict on that.
No, I'm wondering how your family celebrated holidays.
We were not very strict down the line. No. Uh-huh. Sometimes we'd skip going to church, find some reason, some excuse, you know.
Can you tell me how your family, just to sort of change the subject, how your family was affected by World War I, if they were affected at all in any way?
Oh, definitely. Well, World War I, I remember it very well. In 1913, Italy was caught there. Italy was an ally of Germany, German Empire at the time, and the Austrian Hungarian Empire. They controlled most of Europe at that time when the war, and this was in 1913. And then the war, English and French, France, England, and whatever. Some of the Scandinavian countries were always neutral.
But your own family, how was your own family affected?
Well, my own family, of course. They were to go to war because as a revenge for what Austria did to northern Italy. Italy was never a united country until 1970, believe it or not. It's a very young country. See, before that, Italy was just geographical, boot with long boot, and so on. And as a younger, so during the middle of the last century, Austria was under the ruled by Germany practically, yeah. And they wanted Austria to become big, and so it became an empire by taking part of Europe. And Germany, between the two, they controlled all Europe and part of northern Italy also. So Italy was the one who were calling for revenge, and so they decided to become allied of France and England, who
I'm interested in what happened to you during those times. Not necessarily the background.
Well, my family went on the side of Italy. They were patriotic.
Did anyone have
Yeah,
to serve?
Because then Italy would also be expand. We would take part of the Alps area. It belongs to Austria. There was always an argument there. See, and the Alps, you know, you have two, three different languages and so on. You don't get along. And so Austria would expand some more, and also go down on the Balkans, where Yugoslavia was, and all that, the Balkan area, you know, down the Mediterranean, small countries. And they're still fighting now. And,
did you observe any fighting at that time?
Yes, absolutely. I was 12, 13 years old, and I was listening to the speeches that the ordinary men, they had there, of getting together under a portico and talk about politics when the war started. And they were, this was very patriotic. Yes, we should get rid of Austria because Austria has occupied too much territory of the Alps, belonging to us, geographic and so on. And then we should go and help France and England and push Austria back, and also break up the German Empire. And Russia, at that time, was allied of France and England. Also, they wanted to break down the German Empire. Well, anyway, so family was, but I was in favor. I was just a kid. I was favoring neutrality. I said, that's not the way to do it. Have a war just for that. Just fight, you know, we're trying to get a piece by piece, then get together.
Were there any hardships suffered by your family because of the war?
Well, not too much, because we were out of the territory of the fighting, what do you call it, territory. It was the northeast. Italy was occupied, down Veneto, almost as far as Venice, not quite, and part there. But we were on the corner of France, northern Italy from the Alps, Switzerland and Italy. And we were out. We never had the First World War affecting, except obligated to send soldiers over and so on, and help out. Yeah. But the majority were in favor. They were glad that that they broke up, as they used to call it, the German-Austrian Empire, which was Kaiser. Remember the Kaiser? The Kaiser in Austria was Emperor Joseph. Two names.
It's Franz Joseph.
Franz, Francesco Giuseppe. I know it in Italian. In Italian, yeah. How do they say Francis? Francis Joseph.
Franz Joseph.
Franz in German, yeah. Oh, with the Z and the N, yes. That and the N.
Mr. Tonetti, we're going to stop just for a second so I can put a new tape in. We're just going to pause. We're at the end of tape one. Okay, this is Paul Sigrist. We're now beginning tape two with Hector Tonetti, who came from the north of Italy, and we're going to talk about when he came in 1920, when he was 14. Mr. Tonetti, we just finished talking about your recollections of World War I.
Yeah.
And I'd like to begin tape two with you telling me, again, you started telling me about your father going back to America.
Yeah.
But tell me why you wanted to come to America and how that all happened. This would be the second time you would be going.
Mm. Because it was making a better, make it short, we were making a better living here than over there.
How yeah. When did your father go back? Before you came? How long ago did he go before you came?
Well, he went back only for a short while. I'll only say, because he didn't like to work the soil, the land, you know? He didn't like to be a farmer. And so he only stayed there a few years. But then, of course, yeah, and then he came back to New York, because he died in New York. He's buried in the cemetery there, you know, in Queens, the what do you call that cemetery? Holy Calvary,
Calvary.
Yeah, Calvary, yeah. There's two of them there.
Did you have, at that time, did you have any recollections of living in New York as a small child?
Yes, believe it or not, yes, because I went to kindergarten. When I arrived here, I was 3 and a half. They took me, you know which kindergarten took me? French kindergarten. You know why? Because...
Excuse me, we're going to pause just for a minute now, resuming.
Oh, yeah, that's
going to French kindergarten.
That's interesting. Yeah, we were living on 30th Street, one of those, they call it a Hell's Kitchen afterwards, but the slum of New York, you know. 30th Street and 8th Avenue. And they were just, they had just finished, yeah, they did have finished a section of the subway there. And right near the Pennsylvania Station, you know anything about New York?
Mm-hmm.
And the other side of 8th Avenue, the main post office, which I think is still active. But
what do you remember about going to French kindergarten?
Yeah, well, I arrived here at 3 and a half. I was supposed to go to French kindergarten, and we applied nearby, walking distance, of course, 30th Street, and on 28th Street, two blocks below, was a French kindergarten. And in France, it's the only French I know, École Maternelle Française. You understand all those three words. And my mother, they told her that she could apply because we were born where we came from, near the border of France. And our dialect, you know, in Europe they have dialects. When you're born, you don't learn the real language of the country. Not until you go to school at that time. You learn the local dialect. And it's not a written dialect, it's a spoken one. You can spell it, you know. Everybody spells it differently. You know that? You didn't know that, you know, about dialects? And not only Italian, but French and the patois. That means dialect in France. And in German, I don't know, German and so on. All over Europe, they have dialects in different areas and they have to learn. So, a friend of my mother, neighbor over in Brusnango, the same courtyard, they met there. Said to Maria, said, why don't you try to put that in the can, we call it in the garment, the equivalent of the word, you know, at a local school there. Yeah, but that's, they speak French and so on. Well, you know, the kid is 3, 3 and a half. He learns French very, very fast. Madame Anna, remember the name, she was the supervisor. She took us in from what I heard, of course, they didn't talk to me. That because we were born over near France, and our dialect is Piemontese, is something like the area there of France. Well, and we can't think of it now. Everybody knows it except me. And so she accepted me, because I was in the middle, 3 and a half. My baby brother was not born yet. No, of course not. Until then. And the older, 3 years older than me, he was already in the first grade or second grade. You know. And she took me so my mother could go work in the sweatshop there in 7th Avenue. The sweatshop of the women's clothes, you know, whatever you call it. And so she took me in. And so the neighbor said, well, you're not French. She took, yes, because north of Italy is different. And the southern Italian people, a few that she met, they were jealous. How come they wouldn't take my little kid over, you know, from Naples and so on? They didn't know a word of dialect of French or anything. It's a different culture. Now it's getting even.
What do you remember about the experience of
that? I experienced that and went there, and it was very nice. Madame Anna took us. She talked French, and then she talked English, and I knew a few words right away. And we ate at tables, you know, long tables, at lunch. And I remember the backyard and all that there. And then they walked us to school and to homes, accompanied them, because we had to cross 8th Avenue, dangerous even at that time. They still had horses for transportation instead of streetcars. I still had horses, and then the streetcars came in later. And the thing is that I only stayed a year and a half, because then we went back to Italy again. And I liked it. We were taken care of. We were allowed to bring home some leftover, you know, and so on. And we were learning something. Learning to scribble, you know, to draw and all that, yeah.
Well, let's zip ahead to 1920.
I have a picture of the whole classroom.
Oh, in the kindergarten.
Still have it.
In 1920, tell me a little bit about the preparations that were made to get ready to go again to America.
Well, the decision was made by my mother. She wanted it. She couldn't make it in 1920. Yeah, but my father was already here. She was separated from my father through the war period of maybe about 7-8 years, you know. And she had no choice to come back here. And my older brother came in 1917 at the height of the war, because he was accompanied by a local man. He was the guardian, like, you see, because my older brother was 3 years old. So he was six, ready for the first grade, you know. And he came and he stayed with my father. And then we waited another 3 years, because the war was raging, very difficult to get the passport, you see. So 1920 was already finished 2 years. 1918, the war ended in Italy. In the United States, there was a picnic for them. They entered in 1914, I think. All right, and 1917, the war was over for the United States. It was already won, United States and England. But Italy stayed an extra year. And I had no problem at all learning English. But I wasn't a kid.
What did you have to do to get ready?
When I came back in 1920, I was already.
What did you have to do to get ready to leave for Italy in 1920?
Oh, 1920, no problem at all, because who was here? My father was here. Right.
And is it so just you and your one. Mother who are going to travel?
And my mother was with me over there. Right. Yeah. Then I finished the 1920. I finished the grade school. How old was I?
You had gone up to the sixth grade?
Sure, I finished. I didn't tell you why sixth grade. I didn't tell you why I was in the sixth grade, and I went to school 7 years. When I went there, I immediately learned Italian in the first grade, you know. They didn't push me back. But I went to the local parochial school. There was an agreement between the town public school and local parochial school at that time that I could go to that parochial school because the school was in my courtyard, and I'd save half hour, 20 minutes anyway, 25, walk to go to the town school, what do you call it, the school of, the school of the commune of the town, of the, and so I went over here, 1920. I went to the first grade. No, of course not. I was 13 years old. No, he's 14. 14 and a half, almost 15. I was 15 by the time I entered in the fall, September. Yeah, 15. When the first grade over in the...
So they put you in first grade when you came to the United States.
Definitely, yeah.
I see. So at age... Yeah. You were 15 by the time you put into the first grade.
But I already had first and second grade over there in Italian. Here I skipped one of those two, either the first or the second. I skipped one. And I was in line with the other boys. And I was learning the language fast. Because I still know some English words quite a bit, you know. Let me finish this one second.
Okay, sure.
I went 4 years in a row and I passed everyone, the public school. The public school I went, by the way, was built the year I was born. I passed them. And when I was in the fourth grade, my mother told me, that she went to the teacher, who was not a priest. He was teaching the parochial school. His brother was a priest. And I passed every but one then when I arrived in the fourth grade, the classes in the village of the grammar school ended on the fifth grade, only five grades. The next village, the next commune, town, add an extra grade, the sixth. But then, if you go to that school there, then at the end of the you have an extra school in grammar school, and then you have to, if you go into high school, you have to start all over again, you know. And my mother said, no, we have to go back to America, and after a year we'll be learning English right away, because she had been here before. So, could you do something? Give him a 5, which was the equivalent of 50, or their 10 is equivalent of 100. And give him on arithmetic, we had no at that time. I recorded it. The second grade, they already have mathematics. The word was mathematics was for high grades, and so they got together. They said okay, so they sent me to the next village. You know, we were four or five boys, see, and I went to school in sixth grade, and I passed it very easily. But then I came over here, and I went an extra year, because there was no seventh grade. Seventh grade was already what they call junior high or something like that, and so I had seven. That's why I went to school 7 years. But I hardly believe that. I think she knew I was going to finish going to school there and then coming over here. So if he has an extra school here and extra year, I will do him good. She was right. Yeah, that's why.
Where did you go to get the ship?
When?
Where?
Oh, at that time was the Dante Alighieri. It was already Italy. Already Italy was settled. I went in Genoa.
You went to Genoa.
Genoa,
to get
of
the
course,
ship.
Yeah.
And how? And
that's why that's the trip that took us 18 days.
That's right. And it's you and your mother, and who else? You and your
yeah,
mother.
Right. I got a picture. Me, my mother, and the two and one brother.
One brother.
The youngest, because the other brother was
already
here. He arrived in 1917. Right, you remember, and.
My father
was already here, too.
How did you get from your village to Genoa?
Oh, well, through a travel agency.
But, I mean, how did you travel from...
Yeah, by car already.
By automobile?
1920. To Genoa. Automobile. 1920. I don't think we had any carriage.
Train?
Why not? Oh, probably by train. You're right. I think we went by train.
It's quite a distance,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, quite a distance, yeah. And the automobile is in 1920. Well, poor, I guess. Not strong enough. See, we went by train. No horse and carriage, you know. No, because the travel agent took care of about four or five families. We were a big group.
So there was a group of people from your village?
And we slept one night in Genoa, too. We arrived there one day before.
Did you have to undergo any kind of examinations in Genoa?
Oh, definitely.
Before you got on the
before
ship?
Before we got on the ship.
What?
Physical examination, main thing. Health, you know. Now, of course, I developed TB after when I was 20, 22. But I was a long way off from I never had trouble. I was a weakling. I had what they used to call it... whooping cough, and that's where little children had it, babies. I got all kinds of diseases of children. Yeah.
Can you describe for me where on the Dante Alighieri you slept?
Where I slept in the Dante Alighieri?
Yes. Where did you? Can you describe the accommodations?
As the word for you. Very very bad word. People. So you think, oh, you slept with like cattle, which is true. Steerage. You heard that word? Yeah, steerage, yeah. And I was, day 14, almost 15. And we had the picture of passport, my mother, and the two boys, myself and the other boy, together. Do you know what I mean? Just separate that picture, take me apart. Because I was over 14, see? So I had to have a separate, special passport. We delayed 2-3 days, and all that. A special passport for that, because I was over 14. And I had to sleep with the men in the steerage. Husband and wife didn't matter, because it was only 18 days, you know. They were separate. A steerage, big room, you know, cots, two levels. One or the other, a little kid over me, peed in my mouth, my face, and I was there sleeping, woke up, my face was all wet. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's it. That's the right there. And my mother was with my younger brother, who was 6. See, he could sleep with the mama, you know, a different man. And we'd meet every morning. We had what did we have? We didn't have sheets, mattress. We change our underpants and so on. That's all.
Where were you fed on the ship?
Well, we were supposed we had the dining halls. But from Genoa to Naples, we made many stops. The trip was livable, half full and so on. Then they told us, the sailors told us, you complain about this, wait till you reach Naples. And the mob and starts to get in. Yeah. La Canaia, they call it a nickname. We were insulting the southern Italians, Neapolitans, you know, because we were supposed to be superior. So when they arrived, and the men were running, we were in groups together. We used to eat on the deck. The food, we had to stay in line, fill up our sacks, you know, and then carried it with us, a group of 8 or 10, either family or friends that wanted to. That was optional, the way, if you want to. We were all from the same village, three families, I think. So we were all together. We ate on the deck, on top of those air vents, you know, and so on. And because when we saw the dining hall, when the Neapolitans practically over 1,000 got on the same day, and said, well, we're not going to eat in there. What do you stink and everything? Let's eat on the deck. This was already the latter part of March, and we can bear it outside. And the weather was not too bad, except for the seasickness and all that. That's something else. And that's how we ate. And 18 days.
Talk about it.
We had to stop. Talk about the trip.
I was going to say, talk about the seasickness.
Seasickness. I can tell you that because I had it badly. The seasickness seemed to affect teenagers much more than younger brother. My kid brother used to make fun of me, and because he was seven or eight. And he could eat and so on. Then he'd watch me throw up, he'd laugh and go on. He thought it was fun, you know? Yeah. And I had very seasickness. And they gave us the stuff, seasickness. In fact, my mother brought some kind of concoction, liquid, that they told her in the village. Maria, take this and put it in the container there. And it's got onions and so on. And that helps didn't help my, we could buy water, because we had water free. Yeah, and the food was just mostly stew, a couple of times a day, you know, leftover. And then we threw up in the corner regularly. And I got very sick, and I was 14, yeah, that's right. But then I got over it toward the end.
So many people are sick. Were there lavatories somewhere for people to use?
There were lavatories, but by the time you find the lavatory, the corner was my hand there, on the stairways. And this poor man, all they were doing is cleaning up, some of them. Nothing but with the mops and swear and sweepers, you know. Oh yeah, it was a tough thing. And we throw up and the food just wouldn't stay in. We just go, you know, it was not funny. And we had tables in the dining halls, yeah. But as I said, we refused to go at the table.
Because the southern Italians were eating.
Right, yeah. Because they were, some of them, when we got on in Naples, we could not get seats, and they were all taken over by the new arrivals, all those tables. And we had to, more or less, if we wanted to fight, but we didn't, yeah. They kicked us out of the dining hall. And then the smell. So much food, rotten food, so on. Yeah. No, that was not a pleasant trip, and very long. The reason of that length was the war was practically, say, 2 years old. There was a scarcity of everything, you know. And it was scarce. You had to eat what they gave you. And the food was very bad. And so there used to be a lot of seasickness and so on. And the ship was used to keep, the captain used to keep the ship at a, what they call the best speed possible, you know. It was a moderate speed, you know, so that we wouldn't throw up too much. But I did get sick my age. My mother, not too much. And we had to carry our own bag in groups, stand in line, then eat, and then wash our own utensils, you know. Nothing but salt water, and that's the cold water, and keep together and all that. Then when we arrived there, in the port of the harbor, New York City, and the they have the lower bay and the upper bay. And the last meal we got there in the morning, some breakfast, I guess, with breakfast in the morning, and I'm in the upper bay. He said, oh, that's the whole last meal. So they went and got the meal we had left over. What are we going to do with this now? With this, what? This shit here? And this, so what do you do? We ate it, let's throw it out. There goes your garbage, there goes your garbage. Even the sailors didn't dare stop us. We throw away the sacks of the utensils and the plates and the glasses, everything, and leftover food. So when we landed, we didn't have a bit of food to eat, you know. But you couldn't do it anyway.
So you said the food was trip took 18 days.
18 days.
Do you remember seeing the Statue of Liberty?
Who? Statue of Liberty. We landed. Because I lived, in the meantime, I 8-9 years between 1909 and 1920. 1909 and 1911. Three years lived in New York. 1911 we came back, you're right. And then back again, anyway. And this was 1920. We had that old meal in the morning, and what were you saying about
the Statue of Liberty?
Oh, Statue of Liberty, yeah. We saw, we knew all about it, but the harbor was so packed, ships arrivals that were arriving, you know, right after the war, you know. So the Manhattan, the docks were all filled. We had to dock on the New Jersey side, opposite about 14th Street, something like that. And I remember seeing a big sign, Colgate. What is that? Well, it's a factory, and they were Colgate soaps. They were making, and the pier landing was underneath the same building. So, did I sleep there? Yes. Then we had to go through Ellis Island, and we couldn't land in New Jersey, you know. And Ellis Island, I think, by that time belonged to New York City. They're still arguing about it. And so a small boat took us over, and we stayed there 2 nights, just sleeping, dressed up, you know, 2 nights. And then my father came over and claimed us, and then we were all right. We took the boat to South Ferry.
Describe for me what you remember about being at Ellis Island. What sticks out in your mind?
Well, that's when the kid wet my face. Being all those men, I was kind of afraid it might hurt me, you know. But I slept, or I was so tired. I slept to a big hole there, and the cots were in two layers. The kids were usually on top, and the women, of course, the women and the little kids, the women were except I didn't see them, because I was already with the men. And the men down below and the boys on the top. Yeah.
So
it wasn't bad. The food wasn't bad.
Oh, so yes.
We had a standing line, and my kid brother used to come and we ate together from the women's side, because the food, the dining hall were all joined, you know, husband and wife. And I remember my brother, 8 years old, hungry like anything. We spent those tables there, those big sandwich bread, you know. We never saw them in Europe, in Italy. Then we went away here and so on. And my brother was still hungry, you know. The bread, so sweet. Sweet bread like that, you know. Never had it in Europe. Ordinary, just salt and water, and that's the way bread was made. And so my brother used to go back and looked at it, and I remember I was with him, and the woman asked him, hey, little kid, you want more bread? Yeah. He was eating plain bread, he thought he was eating cake. He said, you know, look at it, it's so sweet, it's just like biscotti, it's like, cake. Mm. And we had to stay 2 days because they couldn't, you know, go over and go through inspection in time, in the regular 24 regular one day. So we stayed until, well, on the second day was only part of it. I think we were discharged about noon time.
So you only slept there one night?
Yeah, actually it was there. Only one night.
Did you have to undergo any kind of examination while you were there?
On Ellis Island, no examination, maybe yes. Yes. Because one was in the ship before landing, a day before or something like that. And then on Ellis Island again, yeah. And examined the eyes and ears and so on, the weight and all that. And we went through, yeah. And then we took the...
Who met you at Ellis Island?
Yeah, my father.
Can you describe for me seeing your father?
Yeah, well, seeing my father, I know him and so on. And my father was very cold with my mother. I remember overhearing say, Maria, you look ugly. You're ugly. You're, because she had no makeup, nothing, you know. And I overheard that. I said, she's a son of a gun. He's complaining. He's got his wife with him now, because I was 14 already. And we took the elevated. No taxis. The elevated from South Ferry. There is a subway, but the subway, the 8th Avenue subway was not built yet. So we had to go to 8th Avenue. There was the elevated station, 6th Avenue, 8th Avenue, yeah. 30th Street, that's where I landed. And we stayed there for a while, and then we didn't like it. Ground floor, humidity was high, a regular, what used to call them, railroad flats. Front room and the room on the yard, you had the whole floor. They had windows on both. The other rooms in between, the window was just in a shaft way. And the ones who were sleeping in the middle rooms, they had to let through. The ones sleeping in the back, go through the kitchen and go through there, and it's the whole way.
Did the apartment have electricity?
Oh, yes, at that time, yeah. 1920, oh, yes. But electricity for light only, you know. Gas was still cheaper for cooking. I remember having the gas box there. The gas, yeah.
What were some of your impressions of New York City as a 14-year-old, seeing, of course, you have a whole
different perspective. I was really excited about it. Because I was 14, and I was so tight in saving the nickels. We lived in there, some friends found us a flat, right behind the Pennsylvania Station on 30th Street, between 7th and 8th Avenue. So in order to go to the Biltmore Hotel on Madison and 44th, you had to take the trolley car. Because as I said, there was no subway. Trolley car, 8th Avenue, let's say, 7th Avenue, and then transfer for across town, 42nd Street, to the streetcar there. Yeah. And then walk, Madison and 42nd or 44th, just two short blocks, do that. And it was quite a trip. We had to be in the dining room 6:30 in the morning. 14, 15-year-old girl. Still, they let me work. And
tell me how you got the job at the Biltmore.
As I said, by lying, the agent. My, I tell you how my poor mother there. She said, "Sit down, after I want to talk to you." My other brother was working already. My father was still working, and we were just the two of us. "Sit down," he said. "Look here, the table. I remember just as if we are." He says, "You know your father is sick, he can't work anymore. And you're not even 15, but we'll see. Would you like to go to school or go to work?" I was brought up in your country to help your father and mother and all those stories from the Bible, you know, and so on. Help your parents and not only adore them or something, And so I said, oh, I'll go to work. I figure I have work, I can learn English after school, after work, you know. I didn't realize the hours I had to put in. Instead of the Biltmore Hotel, at 6:30 I had to be in the dining room, the grill room, the ground floor there. So take care, two blocks from, no, three, one block, square block, 43rd to 44th, Madison Avenue, and then 43rd, 44th, Vanderbilt Avenue. An old, brand new building. It was built in 1913, just before the war. And so there, 6:30, I had to get up at 5:30. Then in the morning, I wait for the streetcar, never showed up, 6:30. So I started to walk. 14 short blocks, all right? But then three long blocks from 7th Avenue to Madison Avenue. You know Manhattan well, yeah. And so I did that. In the dining room, ready for breakfast at 7. We set up everything and then ready. Dining room open 7:30. Until 11:30, they serve breakfast. So you have to stay there until 11:30. Then you have time off, half hour for lunch, on the where the help eats, you know, not in the dining room. And then from 12, because since we work for breakfast, we were allowed to go in the dining room right at the moment when they start serving, from 12 to 2:30. And then from 2:30 until 5:30, you had time off. What would you do this after that afternoon? Time off. 14, 15, 20 blocks from the flat, which was nothing but a damp place. And then go back for dinner. Serve dinner. So I walk home and I said, geez, it's a long trip and not too much time. And we had also English schools in the afternoon. A couple of times a week, I was anxious to learn some English, you know. So I took that in, and I walked that. I'm getting you mixed up now. And then one waiter told me, he said, why do you want to go home then in the afternoon? Get some fresh air. So the double buses started to move in, come in. Do you remember the double-deck buses? On 5th Avenue, double fare, 10 cents instead of a nickel. I used to go up, pay a dime all the way at the end of the line, stay there, pay another dime, come back there. And then one day I wanted to see the Hudson River and Palisades and so on, and the city, and I was all excited. But boy, it was a long strain. So I lasted about 2 years.
What was your job at the Biltmore, exactly? What were you doing?
Biltmore Hotel was in the class of the Waldorf Astoria and the Plaza and St. Regis, first-class hotels. They have a graduation. Little kids are 16, supposed to be 16. They make you a silver boy, and you take care of the silver and the water boy. Not even a bus boy. All you take care of, you have your stations in the dining room, here and there. Fill your pitchers of water and make sure there's enough silver all separated, you know, in the different trays and drawers. And that was your job for a while. But then you become busboy. A busboy is a helper of the waiter, you know, clean the table and help set it and so on, but no serving. And the waiter takes the order, the captain usually takes the order. Every waiter has, every captain has half a dozen waiters, two, three tables. Just those tables there, and that's all. That's the way they used to work in those days. And I did that, and then I didn't like it anymore. I wanted to learn a trade.
So you actually started then as a water boy or silver boy?
Silver boy, yeah.
Were they all immigrants who worked at these jobs?
Yes, I would say. And you'd be surprised. There was a segregation already, prejudice among us. And I went there and I talked to a waiter in Italian. And they were all from our area, from North Italy, Piedmont. And they knew dialect and so on. In fact, they used to ask me, did you have a girlfriend before, a girlfriend when you had? I lied. I said, yes, I was only 14, I had no girlfriend. And he was talking dialect and so on. And Southern Italians were hired in the kitchen, clean, all that hard work like that there, Southern Italian only. Take care of the heat. At that time, the heat was the shovel cold. Yes, it was cold. And
so the Southern Italians were hired in.
But not in the dining room. They wouldn't accept. And the head waiter had the not the right, but what do you want? If you didn't want a certain man, you tell the maitre d'hotel. Said no, that man, no. Southern Italians. Only the more menial work. Just at that time, imagine that. So we had North Italians, French, and Germans, some Greeks just beginning to commit. But the Greeks also was born and so on. And the kitchen was strictly French service, French kitchen food and so on. In the kitchen, everybody was speaking French. They had the head steward, the head man. He ordered from, give the slip to the commis, who is the assistant. I became a commis, assistant waiter. Takes the order, takes it, run down to the kitchen. We had stairs besides. And hands it over to the crier, like, he orders. You know, and then in French, he says, he orders so much of this and that, all in French. And then you carry your trays up. Imagine a kid 15 years old, because they promoted me right away. I was only silver boy of a few weeks, few months maybe. And I was small, you know, and was a very hard work.
How much did you get paid?
Paid? $1 or $2 at the most a day. And your meals? And 6 days a week, that was yours, yeah. And the uniform, part of the uniform, yes. Black, stiff front, not the old shirt. And they supplied that. And as I said, in the afternoon, sometimes they told me that there was an English class up on the 18th floor. So instead of going out and around the buses, I used to take English class in the afternoon, between an hour, 2 hour at the most.
Can you describe what that was like?
A school where private teachers or regular teachers from the school system or private schools, you know, and they were considered private schools, you know. Yeah, they were coming. Yeah, because they were nice. She was nice to one, but she didn't know any Italian at all. But I learned fast. And one way of learning English while working all those hours, I had the books and the newspaper, right? But newspaper, I had to read the New York American and New York Journal. They were the equivalent of the Daily News here. Hearst papers. You know, so I learned that, and the signs on the windows. This is the finished one, you know, you had one, believe. S-A-L-E, big sign. And through the window, right on Madison Avenue there, near the hotel, and through the window, I look, I better dash in shirts, all men's clothes, shirts. Italian, S-A-L-E, sale. Italian, S-A-L-E, sale. You know what it is? You know. Short. You see, and you pronounce it sale. So I laughed at myself. It's kind of, it's a joke, you know. Why did they ever sign like that there? So when I got in the room, I told to the waiter, English was the German waiter I had, and I mentioned, what's the idea there? Oh, you didn't fool, got fooled. Well, for a moment I got fooled, but I knew that well it was wrong, yeah. That's what it is. Sale here is salt in Italian. No. And I was watching him. I used to have a little pocket book, pad I took from the club, from the hotel, and I should take home, and I make notes, words I wanted, and look it up in the dictionary the hard way. But I never went full-time school. Then I went to night school for a while. Then I went to bookkeeping school for a while after working. Then I quit. But to school I went when I started working in the factory. Then I had my regular 8 hours, 5.5 days, you know. And the evening I had a little more time to go to school. I never went to regular school. Because at regular school, you don't get paid.
Did your parents speak English?
Neither one nor the other. Well, they knew some words. My mother, believe it or not, my mother more than my father. Yeah, they learned some, yeah. My mother could understand. In fact, I remember we were buying some apples or something on a fruit store there. And they were making fun of hers for an English word. And so my mother got mad at her. Said, me? No. Me no speak English, you no speak Italian, so we're all right, we're even. She got mad at her. Said, I don't speak English, you don't speak Italian. So, why? And, because there's no comparison, you know. And he was trying to show teacher the word, you know. She got offended.
Did you find in your, say, the first couple of years you were here in New York, did you ever experience any prejudice because you were an immigrant from maybe outside of the workplace, any kind of conflict?
Yes. But being North Italian, they could not figure out through my mistakes, my patois, my English massacring, and where I came from. In fact, because even this is years later, when I was working at the club, and a professor of Scottish language, and he was Scottish, not Scotch. He said, professor, so he says, Hector, you have a peculiar accent, more than I have now, you know. He said, You sound like you have a Scottish accent. Scottish, are you Scottish? He took me for a Scotch. So I sort of smiled. I said, no, Professor so-and-so, I forgot his name. I hear him, Italian, you're Italian over here, you know, South Italian, North Italian. Said, I know what you mean, Professor. I come from so-and-so. Oh, no wonder. I knew it was a sort of a brogue, they call it. Sort of brogue, you know. And that's a Scottish brogue. And I said, no. So, oh, sure. They made fun of me. But not me, because I learned English and I was at home by myself. And then we made a pact, P-A-C-T, with my older brother. He was here 3 years ahead of me. And he has studied the hard way, too. So he said, now listen, from now on, we have to take a lesson before you go to bed, English. And we have to make a pact to go together, part in Italian. Not to speak any other language but English. Even if you make mistake, you correct it. It was hard the first few months after that. It was easy. That's how I learned my English. After that, of course, I did have a little bit of a school. Not much. And I read a lot. I read books. Now my eyes are going bad.
Did your parents ever wish to return to Italy to live? Or did they return to Italy to live?
No more after. Because we rented the property there. We rented the property. And they were paying the taxes out of the rental. And my mother's home, except going over and visit. And we used to have enough rooms to stay there.
Oh, so they used to go
in the same house, yeah. Oh, we never rented outside, no. The village was so small. I think there was only one rooming house there. No, yeah.
Do you think of yourself as Italian or as American, or how do you think of yourself?
American, of course. American, because we have so many nationalities here, you know, so many different languages, and then combined, it becomes English. And I've been here so long. And when I left here, 1920, I had made a decision not to go back anymore to live, except visit. That's what I've been doing.
Did you become a citizen, United States citizen?
Oh, as soon as possible. I was so anxious that I almost broke the law. Hello.
How you doing?
We're going to pause. Just
that time was 21, eh?
This it's is when you 21,
yeah.
Citizen,
yeah, right? That time was 21. I would have been 21 in July. In July. What happened?
You applied for
But I wanted to, I applied the papers that I wanted to. Oh, there was an examination in New York City, Long Island City. And December before, 1926, I couldn't do it, anyone let me, because I was not 21 yet. So the minute I got the papers, right away, I applied to a right to vote. And I voted as soon as I was 21. And then most of them, they wait 2-3 years, 4 years, you know. In fact, my father waited about 10 years before he became a citizen. He could have, you know, before. He didn't need it, you know, yeah. Yes, madam.
I was just looking in here.
Yeah, we're going to have to end soon anyway, Mr. Tonetti. I have one final question before we end.
Okay.
Do you have any advice for young people who are just beginning their lives on ways to live their life successfully, maybe rules that you lived by in your own life?
The rule is the common sense rule. Common sense rule. The rule is, when you grow up, try to learn as much as possible and be serious in school, and everything you do, take it seriously, not just as a pastime. In fact, I was so serious when I was going to the special school in the afternoon, the teacher in the hotel, he says, "What do you do on your time off, actor?" I think she called me actor already. And when I go home, I go and lay down and rest, you know. So, "Don't you go out, don't you play football? Any games do you play?" "I have no time. 6.5 days a week, you know." And otherwise, so I never had any too much, you know, sports at all. I never followed football too much. All those games. I worked in a golf club for 28 years. I never played golf seriously. 6 days. And I said, "My day off is Monday. I want to get out of here, no matter how nice it looks. I see it 6 days a week. Go and see my people, my family, and so on, yeah." But I was very serious, yeah. And I did read and write a lot. I read serious books. Books, what do you call it? Not junk. And classics, you know, all classics books. And reading and writing a lot on my own. So when I became sick up in Connecticut here, in connection with this disease here, and I decided I was getting old, I was 75 or so, I decided to write my memoir. I said, very few people know my life, and I want to leave something on. So I wrote in English, little by little, you know, so on. And only for relatives only, private. I didn't want anybody to, because amateur work, you know. And so my brother-in-law and the cousin said, well, can I see them? Say, when can't I have a copy of it? Because you're a cousin. You're already too far distant of the relationship. Anyway, I let myself down, so I included all the cousins. So that meant about 75, 80 copies, maybe more, you know, all the cousins. I tell you only that many because, and then in Italy they wanted one or two, so I have to write in Italian now. So I translated all that in Italian. I have the two. Now this volume, I don't know, you haven't seen it, of this birthday party they gave me. My daughter-in-law and my son, they made up some mementos. The cover, they bought the book cover and so on, then they filled it in. They had everybody contribute something. The title is Remember When. Periods. Remember When. The damn thing is so popular, my gosh, they had to, everybody wanted it.
Well, this is probably a good place for us to end now. I want to thank you very much,
you're
Mr.
Welcome.
Tonetti.
Yeah. So I keep busy all the time.
Hang on a second. This is Paul Segrist signing off with Hector Tonetti on Monday, August 21st, 1995, for the Ellis Island Immigration Oral History Project. Thank you.